behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Evaluating, Optimizing, or Ending Post-Closure Care at Municipal Solid Waste Landfills. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to cover some introductory material on the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team. As we go through the presentation, each of you are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say that as we move through the presentation today. If you're using the Cluent system, the series of orange buttons at the top are going to allow you to navigate. Most often, it's the third button, the single right arrow, that will allow you to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The question mark button is there primarily for our simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is hearing today's training through their computer speakers instead of over the phone line. If you're in the simulcast audience and you'd like to send in a question or a comment, select that question mark button. A screen will come up that will allow you to type in your question. Anyone is welcome to use that at any time during the presentation to send in a comment or a question that I'll receive as a moderator. And we'll get to as many questions as we can during the question and answer breaks. For our phone line audience, I encourage you to ask your own questions out loud, but we do need you to wait until the designated question and answer breaks. We're going to have one in the middle and another at the end of today's presentation. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the technical and regulatory guidance, Evaluating, Optimizing, or Ending Post-Closure Care at Municipal Solid Waste Landfills, based on Site-Specific Data Evaluations, the ALT-4 document. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we encourage you to download the document itself, and we'll take you to a link at the end of the class to allow you to do that. You can also download the presentation that we'll go over during today's training. In addition to what you'll see on the slides, there's more information available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. ITRC provides internet-based training in cooperation with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They host the Cluent website that we're using today.
That's Square View.
So you definitely do need to put your phone on mute. Thank you. A good reminder for everyone on our phone.
The call is over here.
We are picking up background noise, so if you've just joined the call, please be sure that your phone is on mute.
Oh.
On slide two, this is our disclaimer and copyright that we include in all ITRC training presentations. We ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says we try to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide three, here's some information about ITRC. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators and includes federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry who participate through the ITRC Industry Affiliates Program. We also include members from academia and community stakeholders. This diverse group of people get together to address a wide variety of topics that may focus on a specific technology or contaminant or type of site, and we produce documents and training, like today's internet-based training. For more information, I encourage you to go to the ITRC website. We address a wide variety of topics, so there may be information that's available for you that you could use in addition to what you're going to learn today about alternative landfill technology. There's also ways to become more involved in ITRC, and you can read more at the website that I've listed at the top of this slide. On slide four now, this is a list of the course topics for internet-based training that we're offering in 2009. And again, more information is on the ITRC website, including our schedule for the entire year. You can read more about what each course is about, plus learn when it's offered. There's also links to archives for the classes that we have offered previously. We do have an archived version that you can listen to anytime. We also offer a training class, a classroom event on April 6th through 7th in Oklahoma City. That class is on vapor intrusion pathway. Again, more information is available on the ITRC website. On slide five, we have logistical reminders along the left. The key one is to remember to put your phone on mute, and that's star six if you'd like to use our system. Along the right is a presentation overview. About halfway through today's presentation, we are going to take a break for questions, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until the designated question and answer breaks. After the second half of the training, we'll take you to some links to additional resources, and that includes a link to the feedback form. We do ask everyone on the call today to fill out that feedback form. We use that information and really appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. At the end, we plan for more time for questions. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. Both of our instructors are members of the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team. Charles Johnson is a solid waste unit leader at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment in Denver. He issues hazardous waste operating and post-closure permits, as well as oversees corrective action site inspections and characterization, remediation, and post-closure care projects. Charles was the team leader for the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team. Mike Houlihan is principal at Geosyntec Consultants in Columbia, Maryland. He has over 16 years' experience in the design of municipal and hazardous waste landfills, including design and performance evaluation of closure systems. In the past several years, the focus of his practice has been on the development of designs for alternative covers in both wet and dry climates, as well as the application of bioreactor technology at municipal solid waste landfills. On slide 7, I will now turn today's presentation over to Charles Johnson of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Charles?
Thanks, Juliana. And as Juliana said, we're going to take up our internet training today on evaluating, optimizing, and potentially ending post-closure care at MSW facilities. So we're going to start this. We'll pick it up here on slide number 7 right now. And what we're going to talk about a little bit is what we're going to cover today, just kind of an overview, and then we'll get into some details. So first thing we're going to highlight is a new method for evaluating the progress of a facility during post-closure care. Is the facility performing as we expected? Is it in a dynamic state, or is it relatively static and predictable? And we will have a standardized methodology that Mike will introduce you to for conducting that evaluation. We'll also talk a little bit about why we have post-closure care and what is custodial care, which is a relatively new term that we're going to introduce through this guidance document and give some explanation there. As with new and innovative things, we're also going to be fairly candid about discussing the advantages as well as disadvantages of using this method to evaluate post-closure care. And as long as we're talking about post-closure care on MSW facilities, we're also going to get into what are the key components and critical elements of a solid waste landfill that you need to look at and collect data on so you can evaluate that data and assess the performance of that landfill. So let's go now to slide number 8, and we'll talk about the Alternative Landfill Technologies team. As Juliana alluded to, one of the things that ITRC strives to do is to get a broad spectrum of interested parties when we do our guidance documents, because we want to make sure that we're addressing the variety of interests that come to bear on these types of facilities. And as part of this team, you can see in this pie chart that we had federal regulators and state regulators, as Juliana alluded to, ITRC being a state-led organization, Department of Defense representatives, including Air Force, Navy, Army, and also some ANSI representations and other folks there. We had academics on the team. We certainly had the state participation, as we talked about. Department of Energy sat in. Certainly they have landfills where they're evaluating their long-term care. Industry and consulting representatives and citizen stakeholders. So that just gives you a little bit of a feel for the broad spectrum of facilities that we have participating in the team. Let's go now to slide 9. Focus in a little bit more on some of the key discussion topics. One of the things that we want to highlight is that this guidance document is based in regulation, mostly federal, as a lot of the states have adopted with and without modification the federal regulations into their state statutes and regulations for the construct of their solid waste management programs. So we're going to focus down into the fact that post-closure care can actually be shortened or lengthened, and defining the idea of end use up front is before you get into the full design and construction of a facility is a key part of the permitting process. And as we talked about just a second ago, that there are four major components we want to evaluate as part of landfill cover or landfill closure performance, being leachate, landfill gas, groundwater, and the cover system itself. And that we're going to set this up by following some of EPA guidance and evaluating threat or assessing threat at the point of exposure, and that ending post-closure care is possible and practical, and that ends with transitioning into custodial care and the type of care that is required under custodial care, because that's not just a walk away. And besides providing a structured methodology that we alluded to just a second ago, we're going to also delve into the fact that this is performance-based approach, where we're going to collect data on the performance of the landfill, tying back to the four key components that we talked about a little bit earlier. So those are main discussion points. And let's go now to slide 10. And as part of grounding ourselves and starting up the ITRC guidance document here, we wanted to understand the applicability of this guidance document. And certainly we believe that it is applicable to pre-subtitle D, solid waste municipal facilities, subtitle D, solid waste municipal facilities, and historic landfills. But we also believe that if you take a good hard look at this guidance document, while even in the title it specifically states this is for municipal solid waste landfills, if you look at the construct that Mike's going to walk you through a little bit later, and he changed some of the names and some of the titles, and I grew up in the hazardous waste side of the shop before I came over to solid waste, the fact that we actually believe that this could be applicable to brownfield sites, it could be applicable to voluntary cleanup sites, to subtitle C, hazardous waste landfills, as well as Superfund sites. There's a broad spectrum of the types of landfills this is applicable to. But I want to go back to the fact that we are grounded in the municipal solid waste landfills. This is where the predominant amount of our research came from, and that's what we're standing on. When I talk about applicability into other environmental programs, that is based on an understanding of extrapolating from where we're starting today. So let's go now to slide number 11. As part of doing our research for this guidance document, we wanted to actually send a questionnaire out to get some basis points for developing this guidance. And one of the things we asked was, does your state have statutes, regulations, policies, guidance, or business practices related to post-closure care? As virtually every state in the United States is an approved state, the states were indicated yes, they do, and yes, that they had statutes, even though not every state responded to the questionnaire. We did follow-up calling to verify that folks, in fact, had adopted federal regulations into, or federal code into their statutes and then built regulations around them. There's a dramatic fall off when you get from statutory and regulatory requirements on a per state basis to folks have developed policies and guidance on how to actually implement the post-closure care elements called out in their statutes and regulations. And in fact, very few had any, if anything, in policy or guidance. So let's switch from the questionnaire on slide 12 to just a short thumbnail discussion of landfill life cycle. Part of what's germane here is understanding that landfills go through a life cycle from pre-siting to siting to design to construction. Then as you can see in here, after you have the liner and the leachate collection system built in, as you go through time from left to right, that you also go through landfill elements from bottom to top. After the waste is being placed and the waste is exposed to the elements, you're certainly subject to precipitation. And at that time, we know that we can have a good amount of precipitation go through the waste into the leachate collection system, which is then removed from the landfill. Let's mature that landfill a little bit more, moving to the right along the scale and also from bottom to top. We place our intermediate cover. That is the first significant barrier out there to preventing weight or precipitation from getting through the waste and ultimately into the leachate recovery system. And then when we go to final cover, we certainly see typically a significant drop-off through time of leachate generation and production from the landfill. Although at that time we can also see a significant increase, at least in the early years, depending on your climate, of the generation and production of landfill gas. But one of the things that some of the reports that have been coming out in the last 5 to 8 years are indicating that as a landfill matures from liner design through filling, through covering, and ultimate closure, we also see, as I said, general trends that reduce the amount of leachate being generated, and in some situations even see a cleaning up or a reduction in the contaminant or constituent concentrations in the leachate. So that's just a little bit of the thumbnail setting up that we had a regulatory construct. And following that, let's go now to slide 13 and talk about not only the regs, but some of the flexibility in the regulations. And this isn't really meant for you to have to read this. I suspect a lot of the folks on the phone already know this fairly well, that post-closure care must be conducted for 30 years, straight out of the federal regs, and as I said, many of the states have adopted this straight up. However, in the regulatory basis that a post-closure care period may be decreased by the director, if it is demonstrated by the operator that the reduced period of post-closure care is sufficient to protect human health and the environment, again, tying back to an assessment of threat. However, that demonstration also has to be approved by the director. Conversely, post-closure care period may be increased by the director of an approved state if the state determines that the length of the post-closure care period is, again, needed to protect human health and the environment. That gate swings both ways, as it were, based on demonstrations. And those demonstrations, we believe, need to be based on the performance of the landfill, and the performance of the landfill should tie back to critical elements of the landfill, as I said a little bit earlier, in which Mike will walk you through in some detail later. Let's go now to slide 14. Go back over to the questionnaire. One of the things that we wanted to ask our state and team partners was, does the state that you're working in have regulations that contain flexibility in the following categories? And what we're looking at is the duration of post-closure care, the monitoring requirements, financial assurance, transference, land reuse, and property end-use ideas. Many of the states indicated that they believe that actually their regulations did contain flexibility, and again, we had to get some more of that with follow-up. But the problem that we had here is while regulations may identify, as we just talked about, that you can shorten or lengthen post-closure care period, there is nothing in the regulations as to how you would evaluate that. There was no standardized methodologies within the states, and there was not necessarily a consistent approach as to how you would evaluate that data and what conclusions you would come to. Let's go now to slide 15, talk a little bit more about regulatory flexibility and what's actually stated in the federal regulations, that you must maintain the integrity and effectiveness of the cover. That goes to one element that we'll talk to a little bit later. And that the leachate collection system must be maintained, but you may allow that collection to stop if applicable based on a determination that if you stop managing the leachate, that it does not pose a threat to human health and the environment, and that groundwater monitoring must be conducted in accordance with the requirements, if applicable. Interesting here that maintaining the cover of a landfill doesn't mean that you're going to always stay off the landfill. You can maintain it while reusing it in future development schemes, and that, in fact, that reuse, let's say we had a landfill and we put a parking lot on top of it, that reuse may become an integral and key part of the long-term stability of that landfill. As a matter of fact, if we put a parking lot on top with an under-drain system and good runoff controls, we may virtually completely eliminate any moisture from getting into the landfill, which we would expect to reduce the amount of leachate being generated through time. If you reduce the amount of leachate being generated through time, then you may also reduce potential impacts to groundwater through time. So you're starting to see sort of the linkages of these concepts with the ideas and the elements here. Let's go now to slide 17. We talked about regulatory flexibility a little bit earlier. And so we went from the regs as to what was called out, what regulators believed was their regulatory flexibilities. Then we asked the follow-up question is, whether it is specifically or explicitly stated or not, are state regulators actually using their best professional judgment and the data evaluation procedures that they currently have at hand to impart flexibility in long-term post-closure care? A number of the regulators said that there are a variety of areas, as listed on this chart, where, in fact, they are using post-closure care flexibility as part of long-term care strategies in their states. So let's go to slide 17. As long as we're talking about all this, why in the world would we want to optimize or end post-closure care anyways? And is there a benefit? And this is a combination slide. We'll get to some more specific ones in just a minute. One of the things that we're faced with in Colorado is an ever-increasing number of closed landfills. Certainly in the mid-90s, as landfills went from pre-subtitle D to subtitle D, there were quite a few landfills that went into closure at that time. But beyond a whole facility closing, one of the things we're faced with is an ever-increasing number of individual cells at landfills closing. So just by going through time, and with the solid waste facilities servicing the communities that they're part of, we're ending up with more and more closed facilities and more closed cells per facility. So that's an ever-increasing workload, and at least in Colorado, we typically have an ever-static number of regulators to keep up with this. We're always looking for ways to try to improve our efficiencies and to apply our resources where they're needed, where there is a threat, where there is a dynamic situation. Conversely, we're looking for ways to standardize approach to document facilities that are in equilibrium and do not pose a threat and to minimize our resources in those areas. Also, there's the opportunity for land reuse, whether it be recreational, commercial, or agricultural. So those are some of the reasons why we would like to look at optimizing and ending post-closure care. Let's go now to slide 18. Talk a little bit about why optimize from stakeholder and industry perspective. And this chart shows some of the things or ideas that people have brought forward and actually implemented with regards to long-term care at facilities and the benefits. Recreation we've talked about, aesthetics and redevelopment, wildlife, habitat, and education. It's interesting, though, industry brought forward some pretty good perspectives on the fact as we understand what the long-term construct for post-closure care is going to be, they have cost certainty, and also if an industry can evaluate, as we as regulators evaluate also, what is the performance of a landfill, we understand the liability and the threat there and what industry needs to do to make sure that the landfills are maintained in a safe configuration, and we as regulators can do to understand what we need to do to assess that performance and, again, understand the liability of those landfills. Not only that, if you open the door, and we certainly encourage in Colorado the reuse of these landfills, whether it's through a brownfields program, a voluntary cleanup program, or the owners and operators staying in ownership roles, is that they can very much, by using planning up front before design or after the fact if it's already there, create a significant amount of community goodwill. And let's talk about how we integrate design up front. On slide 19, we're going to talk about performance evaluation of post-closure care with the end idea up front. This is part of the siting and the design process for solid waste municipal landfills. It's to sit down up front and look at your surrounding community, talk to the planners, the mayors, the county representatives. What is the growth projection in the area? After 25, 30 years of a landfill's life, how can that landfill best be integrated into the community itself for beneficial reuse? And so you see the characterization bullet followed immediately by established land use strategies. That's a great element because once we understand what the long-term life of that facility is going to be, we can design closure in mind up front so that we can have a closure that, one, complements community reuse, but also is designed to minimize threats and releases from that landfill while integrating to long-term use. That means we understand the stressors on that landfill in the long-term status. We understand how to monitor it so that we know the critical, understanding the critical elements. We monitor the right dynamic points of a landfill so we can evaluate the stress. This is meant to create the idea of optimizing the closure configuration, the closure reuse, with the understanding of the stressors so you can optimize your post-closure care monitoring. You can get exactly the right kind of data you need to understand the performance of that landfill, whether it presents a threat or it does not present a threat, and in fact, how it can best serve the community long-term and present as little threat as possible. Coincident with that would also be required as little care as possible, too. So let's go to slide 20. This is a little bit of what we've been talking about right now, where we understand in the orange circle, what are the site properties current day? And you may have a landfill already in operation, or you may be planning one. And as we look at what's going to happen and we build the landfill, we understand that if it was a prairie or open area at that time, it won't be that once we start our operation. But however, you look in the blue circle and you assess with the community, what are the regional needs? And then you look at the green circle as how do we close that landfill? Again, understanding the closing of that landfill and understanding the needs of long-term utilization of that property are part and parcel of optimizing and minimizing the threat of that landfill, which then should translate to optimizing and minimizing the type of monitoring you need to do and be able to create an exit point for that landfill into future service. Let's go to slide 21 and talk about some of the issues related to this. And Mike's going to get into this from a flow and process and decision process in a little bit. But three key elements is establishing the proposed future landfill use up front, when you do the design, when you do the filling, and when you do the closing. But not only establishing that, because we want to make sure that our closure and our assumptions are consistent. So maintaining the land use after post-closure care and evaluating that the fact that the land is being used as we expected. The landfill itself is performing as we expect. So we have certainty and confidence there. And this is also not meant to be limiting. So that if landfill use changes through time and it's different than our assumptions, we relook at our assumptions. We relook at our stressors. We reevaluate the integrity of that landfill system. Do we need to monitor something in our post-closure design? Do we need to just simply monitor what we're going to be doing in our post-closure care monitoring? Or, in fact, is the secondary use something that's going to put less stress on the landfill, and we may even be more performing more robust management on the landfill than would even be needed? So it's meant to embed flexibility there as well. Continuing a little bit on slide 22 with some of the issues related to this approach, and what you're looking at here is refarming on top of a landfill following in Kansas, and these are actual photos that were provided by Paul Graves, who is a partner with our team. And as you enter custodial care of the landfill after completion of post-closure care, and you exit the regulatory requirement program for long-term care, and you enter custodial care, you still have property management. And that as you exit post-closure care, enter custodial care, that you would in fact eliminate financial assurance, but you still have land management obligations there. Let's go now to slide 23. Talk a little bit more even about issues. One of the things that we appreciate with this is that there's a lack of familiarity with this type of approach. It's an institutional change of having a landfill itself as it goes into long-term care when it doesn't present a threat at the point of exposure, and that assessment of that threat is something that is based on the data and the predictability of the landfill that we know we can exit post-closure care with confidence, is a relatively new construct. And going with that, how do we actually look at that in light of regulatory flexibilities that are already in place? And if we have the regulatory flexibility, how do we build the tools to make an appropriate assessment of the landfill's performance? Let's go to slide 24 now. And one of the things I want to highlight here is that this is a progressive evaluation, and it provides the basis for enhancing or extending or shortening or ending post-closure care. We're not trying to say that it all goes one way. Because one of the things that industry brought out loud and clear when we were developing this guidance document, that if a landfill is in a dynamic situation and that if it still presents a threat, they themselves did not want to decrease or eliminate any of the protective measures that they had in plan. They said that's good community, that's proactive community goodwill, and in fact it's good liability management. It's meant to be a partnering situation. And that the threat evaluation would be based, as we talked about a little bit earlier, on the leachate, the landfill gas, groundwater quality, and the final cap. Let's hop over now to slide 25, talk a little bit about some of the advantages of this process, and embedded in here are some of the disadvantages as well. Again, one of the things that we're going to lead to here with Mike's presentation in just a minute is the fact that we're looking at a standardized methodology that's consistent, and it's a structured approach. There are a lot of advantages to this because as regulators, it gives us consistency across the board, and we can make similar decisions in similar sorts of situations, And if we have different situations, we also can justify why we might be making a different decision. But that standardization and structure and uniform methodology is a huge benefit. Not only that, it helps us identify and demonstrate how a site has reduced or eliminated potential threats. That's what this is about, getting a facility to a safe situation so that we can then change the type of care. And that fact that this is all regulatorily based, whether we extend care or whether we reduce the period of care. And when I say extend or reduce, that means we may find flexibility in our monitoring approach. In other words, maybe we're monitoring quarterly when we start for groundwater, and we end up semi-annual or annual or whatever else may be appropriate. Or maybe we have a whole variety of constituents we're looking at, and we can reduce down to indicator parameters. We want to take advantages of all this. As a regulator in a state such as Colorado, where we have fairly large metropolitan areas and very rural areas, we need to be cognizant of the scalability of the programs that we implement. Just because it's a large facility in a large metro area doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be monitored significantly different than a rural one. Or if it is, we need to have basis and justification for that. Let's go now to slide 26. I'd like to turn it back over to Juliana for our first question and answer session.
Thank you, Charles. We are going to take a break now for questions. If you're in our simulcast audience, you can send in questions using that orange question mark button at the top of the slides. For our phone line audience, I encourage you to ask your own questions out loud. Remember to unmute your phone. If you've used our system, it's *7 to unmute. And when you ask a question, please state your name, your location, and you're welcome to refer to a specific slide number if you'd like. For those of you using the CLUIN system, along the left-hand side is a list of slide numbers, and you can select those numbers to jump backwards and forwards throughout the presentation. Would someone on our phone line like to start with a question?
Yes, I would.
Yes, and you are?
Hi, I'm Donna Sheehan, calling from Illinois.
Yes.
On slide 11, it is shown that two states, I believe, have policy documents, and one has guidance. Do you know which particular states those are?
I don't off the top of my head, but I can look back. First, I'll take a peek in the back of the guidance document, because with our questionnaire, we have the respondent states. But I can also look that up if it's not there and get that back to you.
Okay.
If you could, would you send an email to Juliana, and she can forward that over to me?
Yes, thank you.
And that email would go to training@itrcweb.org. So
okay.
You could just respond to the reminders, confirmation emails that you've got from us.
Thanks.
Do we have additional questions from the phone line audience?
I have a similar question.
Yes.
On slide 8, there are 8 state representatives or 8 representatives from state regulatory agencies. Obviously, Colorado and Kansas are represented. Do we know which other states have representatives on the council?
I can remember some offhand. Again, they're listed in the acknowledgments in the beginning of the guidance document, but I know North and South Carolina were on there. California was a part of the team. I want to say Pennsylvania was also in there. But
New Jersey.
Thank you. New Jersey, that's right.
I believe Virginia.
Yep, exactly. But you can go into that acknowledgement section right near the very beginning, and it has a complete list of all the participants there.
Montana also, Charles.
Oh, that's right, with Rick. Thank you.
This is Juliana. Those are members of the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team from state agencies. ITRC does have members from all 50 states as well as D.C. So if you are interested in learning more about ITRC, there's a state representative from your state. And that information is available on the ITRC website under Contacts. You can go to that page and find out who in your state is from the state environmental agency and who's the point of contact for ITRC. Any additional questions from our phone line audience? do want to wait just a little bit longer to see if simulcast questions come through. Usually it does take a few minutes for those, for someone to type in those questions and then for that to come through to me. Okay, so we haven't got any simulcast questions yet, and if we do get some, we'll go ahead and address those in the second question answer break. For now, let's go ahead and move on to the second part of our training class. This part generally generates quite a few more questions, so we'll have extra time now at the end of today's training to answer those questions. If you move to slide 27, before we continue on with the second half of the training class, I'd like to have everyone in our phone line audience double check to be sure that your phone line is on mute. If you'd like to use our system, it's *6 to mute your line so that we eliminate background noise during the second half of the training. I'll now turn our training class over to Mike Houlihan at Geosyntec Consultants. Mike?
Thanks, Juliana. Boy, one reason maybe we have more questions in the second half is because I talked too fast, so maybe I won't have to do that so much today. If you're on slide 27, I'll be going for the next about 30 slides or so before we get to a break. So please jot your questions down as you get them as we talk here, and then we'll have time for them later. Slide 27 is titled PCC Evaluation Elements. You might remember back on slide 12, Charles had a figure there showing the length of life cycle, and a few pretty important points came out of that I think lead into the discussion of, you know, what landfills look like and what we're trying to accomplish with this evaluation of post-closure care and ending post-closure care. A key thing that slide 12 showed was emissions tend to decrease over time. We said that liners function for a very long time, and also that the cover functions indefinitely if we maintain it properly. So based on that knowledge of how landfills perform over time, what degree of care are we going to need to provide to maintain whatever function and level of care is needed to maintain protection of the environment in the very long term? Well, first, for some background on that, on this slide, we thought we'd lay out the different elements of post-closure care, just for discussion purposes. Let me start on the bottom left. The first one is the leachate collection and recovery system, operation and maintenance of that. And, by the way, these four elements are the four elements of post-closure care that are identified in RCRA Subtitle D for municipal solid waste landfills. So the first element, the leachate collection recovery system, involves the primary and secondary leachate collection systems, if there is a secondary, the liner system itself, the leachate collection system, also a leachate recirculation program, if there ever was one in place or is now. Second element of post-closure care is the groundwater monitoring system, generally involving the groundwater monitoring wells around the landfill. Third, on the top right, is the gas migration control and monitoring system. This involves gas probes and monitoring structures, okay? And fourth and last, at the top, is the CAP monitoring and maintenance system. Now, those are just the four elements under Subtitle D, but as we know, there are a lot of other features of landfills that are important to post-closure care and maintenance and control throughout and after the post-closure care period, and a box on this slide shows some of those, which could include a gas collection system, a surface water monitoring and control system, perimeter securities, and other institutional controls. So whereas Subtitle D identifies these four elements, we know there's some issues beyond just Subtitle D that are necessary to consider when thinking about ending post-closure care. So if you go to slide 28, Charles mentioned in the technical regulatory guidance document, talks in detail about a systematic approach for evaluating the need for post-closure care. And that's what I'd like to get into here with the next few flowcharts. In the next three slides, I'm going to start to talk about this process at an increasing level of detail, okay? And then I'm going to talk about some of the evaluations that are embedded in these processes that I'll be laying out. This slide, 28, shows the most general level of detail of what we're doing. What I want, and then we'll talk about, and this goes into some of the components from slide 27, okay? So on the right side of this slide, you see three bars, and they identify the three different categories of the evaluation. The first vertical bar is labeled prerequisites, and that refers to whether the site has satisfied certain minimum requirements and criteria to even be considered for ending or changing post-closure care. Okay? There are also module-specific prerequisites that we'll talk about in a minute, but these are just general to whether you should be able to consider ending or changing post-closure care at all. The second vertical bar is labeled module evaluations, and this is really the crux of the whole evaluation process. So let me describe what each of these four boxes are. Each of these boxes represents an evaluation module of the process. The first evaluation module involves leachate, the leachate module, and the leachate management system includes the leachate collection system, the transmission system, any leachate storage system, and any leachate treatment and or discharge system, all considered in the leachate module. The second is the gas module. The gas module evaluates active gas management system or a passive system, whichever you had. Perhaps there is no gas release system and there's just passive diffusion through the cap. Whatever the gas management strategy is what you would evaluate within the gas module. The third box is the groundwater module. This involves any monitoring that's done to evaluate groundwater quality, which can include groundwater wells, perhaps vadose zone monitoring, perhaps monitoring of discharges to surface water from groundwater, all considered in the groundwater module. And then last is the CAP module, which involves simply the above ground waste containment system. Now the order of these four modules is pretty important. The leachate and the gas modules represent the sources of possible contamination, and so that's why they're evaluated first. The groundwater module is next in that it involves verification of the performance of those the systems that we have in place to control those potential sources of leachate and landfill gas. And last is the CAP module because it's the final source of control and protection of the environment. And also, importantly, the need for the CAP is, in a large way, a function of the outcomes of the leachate and the gas modules. If there are no threats from leachate or gas, then the need for the CAP is different than if there is a potential threat from leachate or gas. Now, something to point out about the order of these is that if there is no leachate management system or no gas management system, then the system that's described in the Tech Reg document is still set up to evaluate potential threats from those potential sources. So even if there's no system that applies to one of these modules, the model here and the flow system is still designed to work. And last, you should know that you can complete one module, or even if you don't complete a certain module, like leachate, the system still allows you to follow on to do an evaluation of the following module, okay, before ending post-closure care of a previous module. So this was the first and most general level of look at what the evaluation process is. If you can go to slide 29, let me go a little bit deeper in detail. This is the evaluation process for each one of those four modules that I've identified in the middle of slide 28, right? Now, just for a frame of reference here, the first box on top of slide 29 says prerequisites. That's the placeholder for getting into the system at all. The next two boxes, five-step evaluation process and outcomes, is what you would do for each one of these modules. Now, the module evaluations for each module are one of the real contributions, we feel like, of the Tech Reg guidance document to the process of post-closure care evaluation. And so we'll spend quite a bit of time on those in the future, the future slides. Once the five-step evaluation process is done, which I'll talk about in just a minute, there would be an outcome from that evaluation. One of those possible outcomes is to end post-closure care. If that was the outcome, we would go to the bottom box here called custodial care. So the key to the evaluation process for each of the modules is the five-step process, and then the outcome from that process. So let me drill down into a little more detail on those in the next slide. If you'll go to slide 30. Okay, this is in many ways a blow-up of the previous slide. Again, the box at the top called Define End Use Strategy and Satisfy Data Requirements is the placeholder for prerequisites from before. Then we get into these five boxes numbered 1 through 5, which are the five-step evaluation process for each of those four modules of post-closure care. Now, in future slides in, the next discussion for the next 20 slides or so, you'll see this and a key indicating where we are in the process. So hopefully you can tell where the discussion's going in terms of the flow of this flow chart here. But let me read these five boxes to you now so that you can tell what we think that they're about. The first box in the first evaluation step for each of the modules is to see if a change can be evaluated at all. Now, these are specific to the modules themselves. Already there are prerequisites before you get to this step, but then there are prerequisites for each module also that are more specific to that module. Once those prerequisites have been evaluated, then there is an analytical approach to determining whether the change that's being anticipated or planned, perhaps ending post-closure care, perhaps something else, whether that change is appropriate to make and whether there would be impacts of that change that would be threatening to human health or the environment. After that box two evaluate change step is taken, then, and we convince ourselves it was okay to consider making this change, you would go to step three and implement that change. And then right away, go to step four, which is monitoring for the impacts of that change. Based on the results of that monitoring, a conclusion is made when the module is finished at that point, after the monitoring is finished, and we go into the bottom three kind of quadrilateral boxes at the bottom, which are the outcome possibilities. And there are three possible outcomes for the evaluations that we perform for each of these modules. And let me start from left to right. The first possible outcome is that we show that it's appropriate to end post-closure care. And that's kind of the title of our discussion here. If that's demonstrated as the appropriate outcome, then you would proceed to custodial care, which we'll talk about later. The second possible outcome of the evaluations is labeled continue post-closure care at current levels. This implies that it's really not appropriate to end or even change the post-closure care that we're providing for the site. And the third possible outcome is labeled optimize post-closure care. And this is kind of an in-between outcome where it's not appropriate to end post-closure care, but it's really not necessary to continue at the levels that we've been providing in the past. Now, you'll notice that end post-closure care led to a custodial care box, but the other two outcomes led to a loop that threw us back up to the top, labeled reevaluate when appropriate. And what that's intended to imply is that if our ultimate goal is to end post-closure care at some point, and if we found through our evaluation that it wasn't time or appropriate to end post-closure care yet, then at some point in the future we need to cycle back through the whole evaluation. And we'll talk about how that happens later. But in general, it involves reevaluation of the whole process once more data is available that demonstrates that a change is more likely to be appropriate. Now, let's walk through these steps in the next 15 slides or so in groups. The first step we'll talk about is prerequisites, then the five steps, then the range of outcomes, and then we'll talk in more detail about custodial care concepts. Okay? First on slide 31, if you can see on the left side of the slide here, slide 31, you can see the key map, and where we are is at the beginning. These are prerequisites before evaluating any module, any of the four modules. And there's two key prerequisites. The first prerequisite is that the end-use setting of the site has to be defined. The end-use setting for the terms of this discussion are basically the characteristics of the landfill and the surrounding area that determine the potential for a threat, meaning the proximity of receptors, whether they're there, and the nature of the site once it's closed, what the containment systems are, for example. The other key prerequisite is collecting the data that's needed to perform the module evaluations, basically satisfying data requirements for the modules that you want to evaluate. We have this here as an early step because we've found through developing this program that a lot of data is needed to perform the evaluations. And if the evaluator waits until beginning the evaluation to pull together the data, they will surely find that there's not enough data necessary to demonstrate the trends that long-term care decisions need to be based on. So we've tried to make it clear to users that collecting the appropriate data is a step they should think about well in advance of beginning an evaluation. Flip to slide 32, and there's a little more on this topic. The types of data that might be needed for these evaluations, details of the design and construction of the landfill, the history of development of the site, of course data on hydrogeology and climate characteristics and receiving water bodies and surrounding area details. On the right column there, certainly detailed information on quality and quantity of leachate and landfill gas, groundwater quality data, surface water quality data. A few points to take away from this slide at the bottom here. Many sites, as everybody on this call knows, have lots of data on environmental monitoring and data that went into the design process. However, and many sites might have all the data that are needed, but in performing these evaluations, we've found that data needed to demonstrate long-term trends may not be available for all sites. And so evaluating whether that data is available in advance is necessary. Okay, flip to slide 33, please. Now, this figure is intended to just be kind of a reminder for you and lay out the role of the five steps in the whole process. And to remind you of the fact that the modules, these four modules that you see in the middle, are sequential. That the five-step process, which is in the box at the bottom there, applies to each one of those modules. And that, remember, you can finish one step and go to the next, even if you haven't ended post-closure care of one step. Okay? So let's go down to look at the five steps in detail. Slide 34, please. And this, again, is kind of a placeholder to ask you to think about the kind of changes that you might have in mind. Before making an evaluation of a change, of course, you have to know what change you have in mind. What are some examples of changes that we might want to make in post-closure care? The obvious change is ending post-closure care entirely. What other changes you might want to consider making are changing the leachate management approach from active pumping and treating to some kind of passive treatment, perhaps in some kind of a wetland system. Maybe a change would involve going from an active landfill gas management system to either a passive system of wells or a passive system of venting through a cap or something like that. There may be changes in the post-closure care use of the site from a very passive use to a very active and maybe aggressive use. All of those things would change the end-use setting of the site and represent the kinds of changes that we might want to evaluate with this. Ending post-closure care is just one of the changes that is appropriate to evaluate using this process. So once you know what change you want to make, then you can go about evaluating it. So let's go to step one on slide 35. Let's say now that we're past, we've defined the end use, and we have all the data we need to perform the evaluations, and we're ready to evaluate the module steps. Okay. Well, this slide identifies down the left side on those triangles the four modules and a key prerequisite or two for each of the modules. For the leachate module, for example, a key prerequisite is that there is a downward or steady trend in leachate quality and quantity. There are other prerequisites that you'll see in the tech reg document, but we just wanted to pull out a couple here to illustrate for you in this presentation examples of them. For the landfill gas module, a key prerequisite is that there are no impacts at the property boundary or in buildings in the monitoring system. A key groundwater prerequisite is that the site's in detection monitoring, even if it was in assessment or corrective action monitoring in the past and has returned to essentially a detection monitoring program. For the CAP module, a key prerequisite is that all of the other modules have been completed and that the dependence of the CAP performance to maintain the outcomes of those other modules has been defined. Once those prerequisites are satisfied, you can move to step two, which on slide 36 involves a detailed evaluation of the change. The goal of step two is to evaluate whether the change is appropriate and, essentially, whether the change will result in an unacceptable threat. That result drives the outcome of the whole analysis. And since this step represents the bulk of the analytical work that would be performed in completing the module, we're going to talk about this step in a little more detail. One slide for each of the four modules. Beginning over on slide 37, please. Okay? So first let's talk about the leachate module, the evaluate change step for the leachate module. The first thing you would do is define the change you have in mind. The change could be going to a passive method of leachate management or eliminating leachate management, which of course involves letting leachate back up in the cell, and there's a long-term impact to that and a scenario you could imagine associated with that. So how would we evaluate the change that we have in mind? Well, the approach we take in the guidance document is is a step-up evaluation of the change. Okay? Step-up implies an increasing level of detail in the evaluation as you go to higher steps, not an increase in level of protectiveness based on the result of the outcome. Passing any of these steps represents passing the module and an indication that the change should be acceptable and worth implementing. Okay? So, the first step, which would be the easiest kind of comparison to make, would be comparing leachate concentrations directly to discharge standards. You can imagine this is an easy step to evaluate, but the hardest standard to meet. Based on the outcome of that, you may pass, but if it fails, it's appropriate to go up to the next step, an increasing level of detail and evaluation, which involves an evaluation of diluted leachate concentrations at a point of compliance. Again, a harder evaluation involving a dilution attenuation approach at a point of compliance. Based on that outcome, it might be appropriate to move up to the third step, which is an assessment of threat at a point of exposure. Basically, an assessment of risk at a point of exposure. We define point of exposure generally as the closest location that a receptor could be exposed through a credible pathway. But each state, of course, needs to decide for itself what point of exposure means to it and how they regulate it uniquely to their state. And you can imagine this is the hardest evaluation to make, most time-consuming, most costly. Now, I want to point out again, passing any of these steps would make it appropriate to conclude that the change you have in mind would not be expected to represent an increased threat to human health or the environment, and that the change is appropriate. Each step is intended to give an outcome that's just as protective as the others. Easier doesn't mean less protective, just like harder doesn't mean more protective. Each of these outcomes we believe is appropriate and protective. So after the step of evaluation is made, it's appropriate also to consider whether it's time to maybe optimize post-closure care in some ways, maybe optimize the leachate collection system removal approach, maybe frequency of leachate removal or frequency of monitoring, things like that. And any change to the leachate management system would require a modification to the post-closure care plan. So that's a description of the step-up approach to the leachate module. Slide 38 describes the evaluation methodology for the gas module. And again, it has a similar step-up evaluation, but first, needing to define what change you have in mind. Maybe going from an active system to a passive system to no system. Once the change you have in mind is defined, then you would begin this step-up evaluation, the first step of which involves a preliminary screening evaluation. As described in the document, it's a qualitative screening evaluation that's based primarily on the types of changes that you have in mind and the amount of landfill gas generation potential that the landfill has. It uses pretty conservative criteria for a passing outcome. Okay? Step two involves performing an engineering evaluation. This approach is a quantitative screening evaluation as opposed to qualitative in step one, and it's based on an evaluation of the effectiveness of the cover, its proximity to receptors, things like that. It's, of course, more detailed and more data is needed than step one. That's why it's a step up. The third step, step three, is an assessment approach that involves assessment of the threat at a point of exposure. This requires analytical evaluations of the impact of gas constituents on receptors, if gas constituents were to reach those receptors. And as you can imagine, it represents the greatest level of effort in our step-up approach here. As with the leachate module evaluation, passing any step, it represents essentially the same level of protectiveness as the other one, and it implies that it's appropriate to implement the change. All steps are intended to represent the same level of protectiveness. After the step-up evaluation, just like in the leachate module, you would consider whether it's appropriate to optimize post-closure care of your gas management system, and if you made any changes, if any changes were appropriate, to modify the post-closure care plan accordingly. Slide 39, we're on the step two, evaluation of change for the groundwater module. And the purpose of the groundwater module, of course, is to evaluate the potential for future groundwater impacts. Remember, a prerequisite of getting into this evaluation was that we're essentially in detection monitoring it, that there are no significant impacts to groundwater quality at the time you perform this step two evaluation on slide 39. So the goal of this evaluation is to confirm that future impacts aren't expected. How would you do that? Well, you confirm that the amount of time needed to have detected an impact, if it was going to be detected, has passed, that we've had enough time to detect an impact. You would need to consider leachate and, of course, landfill gas potential impacts. And it's important to note that the methodology recognizes that not all landfills that are being considered for post-closure care have liner and leachate collection systems. So there's a different approach required for systems that don't have those leachate collection or recovery systems. Basically, a different approach for estimating leachate quality and its potential for impacts to groundwater. As with the previous two modules, these last two bullets here, there may be opportunities to optimize the groundwater monitoring program, and any changes to groundwater monitoring would require a change to a post-closure care plan. Slide 40. We're down to the fourth and last module, which is the landfill CAP module. The CAP module, as I've discussed before, is much more dependent on the outcomes of the other modules, but it also begins with simply defining the change you have in mind. Changes to the CAP might involve regrading it for a different post-closure use, changing the cover system design because the previous design maybe didn't suit the owner's requirements appropriately, or ending post-closure care entirely. After the change is defined, you would get to the first bullet here, which is defining the post-closure care requirements for that new end use. Okay? What post-closure care requirements would there be going forward? Well, first there are regulatory requirements. These are prescriptive requirements that you just don't have much flexibility with under the state requirements. The second category of post-closure requirements for the CAP are requirements established by the outcomes of the other modules, the gas or the leachate modules, I mean. The gas module, for example, if there's no gas being generated at your site, then letting liquid in might not be expected. Letting liquid through the CAP might have an impact on the amount of gas that's generated, for example. And the outcome of the landfill gas module would indicate that and therefore represent a requirement for performance for the landfill CAP throughout and after post-closure care. So that's an example of a requirement established by the outcomes of the modules. And the third kind of requirements for post-closure care of the CAP are simply performance requirements, that it manage stormwater appropriately and things like that. Once the post-closure care requirements have been defined, you would go to the next bullet, which is evaluate the compliance of the modified CAP with those post-closure care requirements. And if it's concluded that those post-closure care requirements should be satisfied by the modified CAP, then you would conclude that it's appropriate to modify the CAP accordingly. As with the other modules, you'd look for opportunities to optimize the monitoring and maintenance program for the CAP. Maybe the monitoring plan or enhancing the vegetation so there's less monitoring or management requirements, things like that, and modifying the post-closure care plan if there are any changes to the CAP. Okay, slide 41, please. Now we're done with the step 2 module evaluations for each of the modules, and we go quickly to step 3, which is implementing the change if it was concluded in step 2 that no adverse impacts would be expected from the change. So at this point, we would modify our CAP or change our gas management system from active to passive or whatever other change we had been evaluating or go to ending post-closure care if that's what we were evaluating for. And immediately we'd, on slide 42, jump to the next step, which is step 4, monitoring the impact of the change. This is a real contribution of the approach to evaluating the appropriateness of ending post-closure care, we believe. The purpose of the monitoring that we discuss here is to confirm that the changes that you made in step 3 work as they were intended to, as they were predicted to. There's two types of monitoring in this step 4. The first is confirmation, and the second is surveillance monitoring. Confirmation is monitoring performed during post-closure care, meaning during the regulatory post-closure care period for the site, with the intent of confirming that the change resulted in the outcome that we predicted in the step 2 evaluation. The other kind of monitoring is surveillance, which is monitoring after post-closure care has ended. monitoring for an extended period of time just to further validate that the decision to end post-closure care for that module was really appropriate, kind of like insurance monitoring. Let's talk about those kinds of monitoring for a few minutes. Slide 43, confirmation monitoring. What's this about? Well, let me read the definition here because I think it's important. Confirmation monitoring is demonstrating that the data on which the evaluation was performed is complete and that that data documents the existence of the trends that the evaluation was based on. The decision to end or modify post-closure care is based on trends in the data that we established during the Step 2 evaluations and in the prerequisites. So during confirmation monitoring, we want to make sure that those trends have not been changed by the change in post-closure care that we implemented. Confirmation monitoring is performed for the duration established in Step 2 and the frequencies established then, and the compliance with that data, procedures for evaluating compliance, are also established during Step 2. So by the time we get to confirmation monitoring, there's a whole monitoring program already established to perform it. Now, moving forward here, if the goal of confirmation monitoring was to show that it was okay to end post-closure care, and you pass that monitoring, then you'd go to surveillance. I realize I'm talking about a flowchart here in your mind. But I want to get to the point of, and we'll get to that step next, going to surveillance monitoring. But first, what happens if your confirmation monitoring doesn't turn out as you expected it to? Well, we need to respond to that, and slide 44 talks about that. There's two possible outcomes of confirmation monitoring turning out not the way we expected it to. The first one is the worst outcome, which is the data, confirmation monitoring data shows that we're all of a sudden out of compliance with regulatory limits. In this case, we'd quickly evaluate the cause, decide how far back we had to go in monitoring, perhaps to the post-closure care monitoring levels that we had originally had for the site. Out of compliance is one possible outcome. The other outcome, though, which is maybe more likely for sites that have reached a degree of stability, is that the data shows that there are changes, but that the data is still within compliance. So what do we do in that case? The site's still in compliance, but it's not performing exactly the way we expected it to. Well, first we'd evaluate the need for whatever responsive action there would be, and that could include evaluating the data further, maybe collecting more data, maybe returning to a previous level of care for a while we did the evaluation. And an example of this kind of outcome is, let's say you turn off your gas collection system because your Step 2 evaluation showed that it should be appropriate to, and then you detect gas in monitoring points above the predicted levels but below regulatory thresholds. In this case, maybe you'd increase your frequency, go back to a previous level of management, and evaluate more and reconsider whether the change that we had in mind really was based on data that was adequate to make that determination. Slide 45. All right, now we get back to confirmation monitoring provided an outcome that we expected. Well, what do we do in that case? Well, again, there's two possible outcomes. If confirmation monitoring showed us what we expected and we're not ending post-closure care, then you'd continue monitoring under the program that you had until it was time to cycle back and do an evaluation of ending post-closure care. But if confirmation monitoring was successful and on a path to ending post-closure care, at that point, we jump to surveillance monitoring. Surveillance monitoring is intended to provide a longer-term monitoring at a reduced level, actually at a reducing level, just to document that our decision to end post-closure care was appropriate. During this stage, during surveillance monitoring, there's no operation and maintenance being performed under a regulatory post-closure care period. There are no controls that exist other than those that would be part of the custodial care program. So essentially, by this point, it's been demonstrated that the waste management unit has reached some degree of self-sustaining ability. Slide 46, what kind of outcomes are there for surveillance monitoring? As with everything, two possible outcomes. First, monitoring results turn out the way we expected. Well, in that case, we'd develop our custodial care program, which I'll talk about in a minute, and proceed to implementing it. If surveillance monitoring doesn't turn out as we expected, at that point, we'd reevaluate the whole decision to terminate or end our post-closure care. Noting that, of course, completion of surveillance monitoring represents the end of regulatory post-closure care. And at the end of surveillance monitoring, we would establish our custodial care program and move into it. So, slide 47. So at this point, we've completed the module evaluations and we're at the outcomes. And you see those three outcomes on the bottom of the slide there, which are the possible outcomes. But we put these pictures on this slide here to let you know what things look like at this point. By this point, your site has probably looked like these photos for many years, 20, 30 or so years. And at this point, the site should have reached a pretty high degree of stability, functional stability. And many sites in this condition are ready to be reused. Many big landfills around the world are being reused and redeveloped and having an end use that wasn't anticipated early that could benefit from an evaluation of this type. So let's talk about those outcomes for just a minute. Slide 48, we have the three types of outcomes. I'm going to talk about them in order of first, continuing post-closure care at current levels. That's the highest of those three outcomes on the bottom. And then second, we'll talk about an outcome that results in optimizing post-closure care. And then third and last, we'll talk about the outcome that represents ending post-closure care. It's easier to flow into the custodial care if we do it that way. So, slide 49, the first outcome, continuing post-closure care at current levels. For this outcome, one or more of those four modules still requires post-closure care at current levels, not substantially optimized levels, but at current levels. So if this is the outcome of the evaluations, then the evaluations need to be performed again in the future before post-closure care could be changed or ended. So that's the first outcome. Now, slide 50. What's the second outcome? An outcome that shows that optimizing post-closure care is appropriate. Optimizing meaning, the first bullet there, that the intensity or scope of post-closure care for that module could be reduced. Reducing the number of monitoring wells or analytes, perhaps. The frequency of monitoring or maintenance of the different features of your post-closure care system. Now, for optimization to be appropriate, the change to optimizing it must be demonstrated to not have an adverse effect on the environment or on the ability, on our ability to monitor and maintain the landfill during post-closure care. In this sense, the justification to optimize post-closure care depends on human health and environment considerations. And, as the last bullet shows, requires a change in post-closure care and maintenance plans. Slide 51 shows a cut from the tech reg document on optimization. This is a case that I think many of you may be familiar with, just optimizing the groundwater monitoring program for a site. You see, especially on the bottom of this slide 51, a whole bunch of different waste management units that at one point were monitored independently but overlap a lot. And optimizing for this site in terms of groundwater monitoring meant reducing wells, considering units in terms of areas, and minimizing the amount of data that was collected to just what was needed to really evaluate impact to the environment. Slide 52. The third outcome, an outcome that showed that ending post-closure care was appropriate. At this level of an outcome, all confirmation monitoring and surveillance monitoring and also maintenance are concluded under any regulatory program that a state would implement. Regulatory required post-closure care at this step has been completed, but I want to point out there's no walk away from the site. In previous webinars, between Charles and me, questions had come up about whether ending post-closure care the way we're describing it here really represents an owner's ability or preference to walk away from a site and not provide care anymore. But that's really not what this program leads to. And I really want to point that out. The fact that a regulatory post-closure care program has ended doesn't mean that care ends. And that's what the whole custodial care concept's about that Charles introduced before. Custodial care identifies and establishes whatever de minimis level of care is required for the site that's appropriate to maintain it to be protective of human health and the environment after regulatory post-closure care has ended. Let's go to slide 53. So, ending post-closure care, what might that look like for a site? Well, here's what we've suggested as requirements for ending post-closure care. Now, this list here that I'll go through is a bunch of qualitative illustrations, and we think make the point in the time we have, but we want you to remember that the evaluation in the tech reg document is really very quantitative. It's analytic and quantitative, not qualitative. But these qualitative points on this slide, we think, give you a vision of what a site ending post-closure care, you know, might look like. Well, for the leachate management system, the concentrations of leachate for such a site don't pose a threat to human health or the environment. And the buildup of leachate, you've probably heard the term bathtub effect, you know, the landfill filling up with leachate over a long period of time doesn't represent a threat either for a site that's ready to end post-closure care. The landfill gas management system, well, gas migration in the future, even if it were to occur, would not represent a threat for a site to be appropriate for ending post-closure care. Groundwater monitoring, well, the site would still have to be in detection monitoring, and monitoring would have had to be performed for long enough to have detected a release if it were to occur. And ending post-closure care for the final cover, well, it would have to be demonstrated that the cap would be adequate to maintain the outcomes of the other modules, and that containment of waste is addressed through after the end of the post-closure care period. And most importantly down here, that only de minimis care would be needed to maintain the cap to the degree that it can satisfy the outcomes of the other modules. Now, complicated, but remember, we're talking about a site that's been through many years of post-closure care and has demonstrated a degree through the evaluations in step two that we talked about a while ago, a degree of self-sustenance and a lack of potential threat to the environment. Slide 54. What happens after surveillance monitoring? Well, pointing out again, this is where regulatory post-closure care ends. And importantly, this is where financial assurance ends, a key point that we'll talk about in a moment. And this is where custodial care begins. Slide 55, what about custodial care? Well, custodial care involves the features identified in this list. And, of course, it's the last box in a flowchart on the right there. It involves a continuing obligation to care for the coast landfill, even though it's outside of the jurisdiction of a solid waste regulatory authority. That obligation would ensure that the site doesn't pose a threat to human health or the environment. And it would do that through institutional controls or covenants to ensure that the protective conditions exist as long as they're needed. Those controls or covenants could involve deed restrictions. There may be many alternative land use control mechanisms because the laws vary a lot from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but covenants are a good example of how these kinds of institutional controls can have a life that extends beyond regulatory post-closure care. Slide 56. What might a site in custodial care look like again? Well, here's a list of a few things. It would have to have a history of good recent performance of containment and environmental protection. Not just a history in the past, but a recent history after post-closure care had been reduced and monitored through the surveillance monitoring period. Maintenance of the top layer of the cap would be as a necessary component of a custodial care program. Soil erodes, you know. After regulatory care ends, there will be a need to do maintenance of a cap, but it should be de minimis care of the cap. It doesn't require regulatory oversight. Next, maintenance of site control features would be needed. Institutional controls, for example, fences, stormwater controls, mowing. If these are needed, they would have to be part of the custodial care program. Let me leave you with a thought, just a concept of what I think of as custodial care. It's whatever care is needed to manage the site when the site no longer needs the degree of oversight prescribed in a state's solid waste requirements. So, with that, we get to the topic of financial assurance. Go to slide 57. The end of regulatory post-closure care implies the end of regulatory financial assurance. And Charles will talk through that. Charles?
Thank you, Mike. As Mike said, we're on slide 57 now regarding financial assurance mechanisms. As you probably gathered through this, it's the idea of working with landfills to assess on a performance-based methodology where the landfill is in its life cycle. And as part of this is what Mike's talking about, is the opportunity to exit regulatory post-closure care and migrate into custodial care. We certainly appreciate that through all of the closure requirements as well as post-closure care requirements, that financial assurance is a key element there. And as part of this team, when we were developing the guidance, we started to actually write a section about financial assurance. And as we delved into that and educated ourselves about the current status of financial assurance, current status of financial assurance statutes, regulations, and mechanisms, we realized that while this is a very worthwhile topic, it was actually larger than what we would be able to accommodate appropriately in this guidance document. Based on that, we decided to not write a financial assurance section at that time, but we did develop some rules of thumb regarding financial assurance, and we wanted to share that and offer some of our recommendations. First is that funding should be reevaluated, and it should be reevaluated on several bases. One is, are there modifications to the long-term care program that impact the amount of cost associated for financial assurance? And that, when you're looking at adjustments to the landfill and its care, that you should use the outcomes of the four-module evaluation approach that Mike just detailed for you to help establish what's an appropriate monitoring program for which elements and what would be the appropriate frequencies and data needs for that to support the assessment and evaluation and performance of the landfill. Your financial assurance should tie back to that. Similar as we do in any sampling programs, is we should be able to justify the samples that are needed. In this, the tools that Mike laid out is an appropriate methodology to justify the required amount of physical and resource obligations and tie that back to financial assurance. Second thing that was significant was brought to us from a variety of our partners, and some of which were our state regulators that, like myself, have rural counties that have to provide financial assurance, is that do not get to the end of post-closure care, year 29 out of 30, and say, oh, by the way, we're going to extend the post-closure care period for another 25 years or 5 years or 6 months, and here's your list of obligations. Because what that means to the facility side, yes, they need a work plan and they have to put their obligations in place, but they also have to fund those and provide financial assurance for that. As a team, we recommend looking 10 years out before ending post-closure care so that you can really look at what's going on at the facility, what is the performance of the facility, really think about optimizing post-closure care at that point so that it is on point with the type of data that you need to evaluate the performance of that facility and to tailor the financial assurance requirements for that. Because, as with some of our small rural counties, it takes them quite a while to raise the funds to do these projects as well as to maintain their financial assurance. So certainly we think that was a strong recommendation. Don't play gotcha at the end. Let's work more proactively. And to ensure that the amount is adequate, that it's reasonably anticipated based on post-closure care period, and is based, and that in turn is based on the performance of the landfill. Again, you can see the internal consistency here. We want to use the approach that Mike has outlined here not only to help understand what is the appropriate monitoring and data requirements, resource needs, and financial assurance for that, but also to help us get an understanding of where we are in the life cycle of that facility and where that facility is in the regulatory life cycle, and so that we make sure that we have appropriate financial assurance to cover our activities until the end of regulatory care. Let's go now to slide 58. And a quick wrap-up and summary of this before we get to some more questions. As we talked about before, this guidance document and what we're outlining here is founded in regulatory basis. And the first piece of that is post-closure care can be shortened or lengthened. But that defining the end of post-closure care for successfully closed landfill is an important first step. In other words, as we talked about earlier, let's make sure we design with the end in mind, and that we understand the critical components that we need to assess, such as leachate, gas, groundwater, and the cover system, to understand the performance of that landfill, where it is in its life cycle, where it is in its regulatory life cycle, and at the end of post-closure care, when a landfill no longer poses a threat to human health and the environment, as we said, based on performance evaluation with a structured methodology with an appropriate set of data. And that ending post-closure care is possible as well as practical, and that is called out in the regulations, and that custodial care after post-closure care ends involves de minimis amounts of cure. However, there is still a responsible party there. And as we talked about, you can look at these as to whether or not we're making the right decisions. So we want to encourage the use of this methodology. We want to encourage the use of states and agencies and even industry and everybody else to develop a standardized methodology that we can all agree on that fits our state's needs, regulatory and statutory basis, and also evaluates the actual site conditions. One of the things that we also found from another number of our rural counties in Colorado as I visited with them is they actually said, we don't have this, but we need this, because it gives us a way to manage the state's expectations for evaluating our post-closure care. They said at least everybody can get on the same page. That being said, let's go now to slide 59. Chat a little bit about some of the other organizations and their information that we use. We certainly stood on the shoulders of the Solid Waste Association of North America, the National Solid Waste Management Association, the National Solid Waste Management Authority, and EPA. Also, a key underpinning of all this was the Environmental Research and Education's information, because they actually have a guidance document that supports this, or actually not a guidance document, but an implementation document. What this guidance lays out is a decision methodology. You can look at the EREF document, and it actually provides statistical means, data assessment, and actual methodologies for conducting an evaluation of the data so that you can come to decisions as to the performance of a landfill and where it is in its regulatory and physical life. Yeah, so we certainly want to recognize those sources of information and their assistance in this guidance. Let's go now to slide 60, talk about some follow-up type guidance that we're interested in developing and that we have in place right now. For right now, the ITRC has available guidance documents and internet-based training classes, and you can get those off the ITRC website. However, as you might imagine, what we're talking here is a fairly large topic with a lot of substance to it. And in the future, the ITRC is considering developing an expert system and classroom training. Unfortunately, we're a little bit short on funding for that right now, and it's a future optimistic development that we'd like to see come to fruition. But as y'all can provide feedback, and Juliana will talk about that in just a minute, please think about what you and your agency or your facility or your county or you as a citizen or as a consultant would like to see as future development of this topic so that we can mature the concept, and not just the concept but the full implementation of a standardized and routine methodology. When I say standardized, that doesn't mean one national approach, but so that agencies such as ours in Colorado, we can develop our own procedures and protocols, sit down with industry, with consultants, and regulated facilities, and talk about what is a good approach here. How do we embrace the concepts and the ideas and methodologies that Mike has discussed today so that we can have a consistent set of expectations so that we can also know what data we need to get in advance. Because I don't think any of us wants to get to the point in a post-closure care period where we're basing our final determinations as to what is the appropriate regulatory status of a facility just based on a minimal amount of data that doesn't necessarily fully address the performance of all the key elements of a landfill system. We want to make sure we're getting the right data, we're getting it early, we're getting the right data so we can analyze it early enough, point by point, as well as on trend. So think about some of that as you look towards providing some feedback for us on this guidance document. And at this point, I'd like to go to slide 61 and turn it back over to Juliana.
Thank you, Charles. We are going to take time for questions, but before we do that, I want to take you to the links to additional resources. So if you select that area of the slide, that's going to take you over to the links page associated with today's training class. And we've listed this URL on the slide because these links are going to continue to be available for you as a resource. Before we talk about the links, I want to show you how to get to the feedback form. If you look to the left under that clue in sun, the third item listed is feedback. And we do look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. If you have several people participating at your location, each person can fill out the feedback form separately, or you can do it as a group, however you prefer. On the links page, looking to the right, the first item we show there is our two-day classroom training on vapor intrusion pathways. So if you're interested in that, select that area. That's going to take you over to more information about that training class. In Section 1, download today's ITRC training. This is what's going to allow you to open a page that will let you download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what you see on the slides, more information is available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. The next item we list is the ALT 4 document, ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance, Evaluating, Optimizing, or Ending Post-Closure Care at Municipal Solid Waste Landfills Based on Site-Specific Data Evaluation. That link's going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can immediately download a PDF of the document, or you can order a hard copy. That same link also allows you to see the other documents produced by the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team. We also have internet-based training associated with those, and in Section 1, there's links to take you to those pages. In Section 2, we've talked during today's training about other ITRC documents and associated internet-based trainings. And Section 2 is a list of those links where you can easily get to more information. And in Section 3 and 4, we have documents, websites, and organizations that you may find useful as you go through this information. And, of course, in Section 5 and 6, there's links to the ITRC website and ClueIn. We do now want to take time for questions. For our phone line audience, remember to unmute your phone and state your name, location, and organization when you ask a question. For our simulcast audience, back on the slides, there's that orange question mark button that's going to allow you to send in questions. If you've used our system, it's star 7 to unmute. Do we have questions from the phone audience to start? A simulcast question from Juliet Dennis at Ohio Department of Transportation. How would PCC be performed for historic landfills that were developed prior to regulations and or guidance and are currently inactive and have been for decades prior to any regulations and or guidance? Would PCC approach requirements differ?
Charles, you want to try it?
I would say, sure. Thanks, Mike. Yes, the requirements would be different because one of the things that we may not have information on, well, first off, the data collection requirements may be, I'll back up, the data that had been collected during post-closure care may not be, allow us to answer all the critical questions that we had to answer. One of these is going to relate to the fact if it's a pre-subtitle D or a historical landfill, we may not necessarily have a liner or a leachate collection system. So in the absence of that, the question is going to come back to how long has it been closed, how effective is the cover? Because if we have confidence in the cover, we may then be able to plug back into the idea of even if we don't have a leachate collection system in that specific data. If it is a pre-sub D, and we have some of these certainly here in Colorado, and I don't mean that they were closed in 94, I mean they were closed in 74 and 68, and we have some of those that we're working with right now. And one of the things we're actively trying to do is look at a lot of the methodology you saw and heard about today from Mike, understanding that we have gaps. We don't have leachate volume data. We don't have leachate quality data, but what we do have is some pretty good groundwater data, and we're trying to understand how to extrapolate that data back to the overall performance and integrity of the landfill system, understanding that we're missing a key element. But what we have on our side is monitoring for chlorides and some solvents, which are very rapid movers through the environment and are good early warning indicators, and we have many more years of data under our belt than some of the new systems have right now. So would the requirements be different? Yes, I think it would be tailored to your site. Can you take advantage of the length of data that you have? Yes, there still may be a couple data gaps that as an agency and as a landfill that y'all need to fill in there, though.
I'd add to that the underscore that the method works for pretty much all solid waste landfills.
Uh-huh.
The guidance document is focused on Subtitle D sites because we had to bite off something that we could, you know, address accurately and thoroughly. But the methodology works for pre-subtitle D landfills clearly. The criteria are different, as Charles said. And Julia, if you'd like some input on how to try that, you know, it's been done for several sites of the type that you're talking about. So if you want to follow up later, I'd be happy to help you.
Contact information for instructors is on slide 6, so that's a great way to get a hold of specific instructors. A simulcast question from Frederick Moore at Oregon DEQ in Bend. Assuming a facility is in custodial care, what enforcement mechanisms, if any, do you think would be in place in the unlikely and unplanned event that a threat to human health and the environment develops?
That's definitely a question for the regular.
Yeah, and we're talking about a site that is in custodial care. Do I understand that correctly, Juliana?
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, in Colorado, well, I'll back up a little bit. One of the things that we talked about is use of appropriate long-term care mechanisms. In Colorado, we have an environmental covenant law, and any time somebody closes with waste in place, they have to get an environmental covenant. And even if they transition into custodial care, if the facility is static and if the facility or is in equilibrium and its performance is in really good shape, if it transitions out, but it could present a threat, that environmental covenant could come forward. The advantage of that is you could allow somebody to have a mechanism such as that to transition out of regulatory post-closure care into custodial care. And you can have a clause in there that says, if in fact something changes at the facility, and Mike was talking about this, is we're supposed to have pretty good confidence that it's not going to change. However, things can happen. Under the environmental covenant, we could re-loop back into post-closure care if something happened. But even more appropriately than that, let's say a facility is in post-closure care and a release is identified. That's a new release of solid waste, and it would trigger our solid waste regulatory authorities, and we could sit down and start negotiating with the facility as to where are they in the regulatory process and what's an appropriate response mechanism. The long-winded way of saying in Colorado, at least, we believe, yes, if there is a release, even after you're in custodial care, that you could come back into the regulatory framework. Interestingly enough, that's something that our brownfield folks and our voluntary cleanup folks deal with on a routine basis, because they have facilities at exit remediation projects with waste actually still in place. However, if they have an erosion into a cover system, they can re-loop back into requirements to fix that.
A question from Pete Marshall at AD Lanter Consulting in Alberta, Canada. Could you speak to the types of conditions that would be attached to an environmental covenant?
Well, for us, we can actually attach individual specific conditions, such as during, and let's go to a covenant that's in place with custodial care, that somebody would survey that property annually. And if there is a deterioration of a key element, as we talked about, let's say cover erosion, that then they would have a trigger to contact a regulatory agency to sit down and start that discussion. However, our environmental covenants sometimes include a whole management plan embedded in it, not just specific elements, but it may say on an annual basis you're going to make sure that if it was a parking lot, it is still a parking lot, and somebody hasn't gone out there and bladed it up. So you could go into change of use conditions or deterioration type conditions. But those are very site specific and developed between the agency and the facility. But there is latitude even in property management construct of custodial care to at least include good evaluation of strong indicators of performance out there. And certainly, I guess, what we look for is change of conditions.
Thank you. Do we have questions from our phone line audience? We are out of questions from our simulcast audience as well, so we'll go ahead and wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants. Thank you for joining us today. Please fill out the feedback form. We do look for your feedback, and we use that information as we continue to develop training courses. For more information about ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.